Okay. Proverbs 5. The next few sections, again, are really going to be about choices. Solomon is trying to warn his son here, make godly choices instead of wicked ones. And we had mentioned Galatians 6, verses 7 and 8, and I'll just read those again just as a reminder. Do not be deceived, God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, that will he also reap. For he who sows to his flesh will of the flesh reap corruption, but he who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life. And one assurity in life, we all make choices, and those choices are going to have consequences, and Solomon is going to warn of that. Certainly Paul did in Galatians 6 there. We talked a little bit last week as we were closing that idea. I remember old cartoons, and you'd have a character do something wrong and they'd say, well, the devil made me do it. Absolutely ridiculous. The devil can tempt and he can provide opportunities, but who does the sinning?
We do.
That's us. That's on us. We make the decision. We make the choice to choose right or wrong, and that's on us. He certainly gives us opportunities. I'm not denying that, but we're the ones who make the decision to do right or to do wrong. If I sin, it's because I choose to. Let's look at verses 1 and 2. My son, pay attention to my wisdom. Lend your ear to my understanding, that you may preserve discretion and your lips may keep knowledge. Son, listen to me. I'm about to say something to you that will save your life. Son, and just a reminder, our society promotes things that encourage immorality. They encourage selfishness. And then he's saying, listen to me. Lend your ear to me. I'm telling you something that you desperately need to know, that you may preserve discretion, that your lips may keep knowledge. These things will make you better, son. Listen to me. And then he immediately goes into a warning about the seductress. And we're going to see this theme throughout the book of Proverbs. A number of times we saw it earlier, and here in chapter 5 we see it again, this warning that he gives. Someone will read verses 3 through 6 for us.
In the midst of a strange woman, drops as a honeycomb, and her mouth is smoother than oil, but her end is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. Her steps take hold on hair. Just as she ponder the path of life. Her ways are movable, that thou canst not know them.
Okay. Bobby's reading from the King James Version. I like the way that it words it. The strange woman. A lot of your other versions may have seductress or the immoral woman there. And it's interesting when you see strange woman. Strange in what sense? Strange in the sense that she doesn't belong to you. She is a stranger to you. You don't have any right to her. And certainly immoral woman, it tells us this is describing the behavior of a seductress. And Solomon's warning his son, don't do it. Don't go near her. Let's just look at some of the things there. What is her speech like?
Like honey.
The temptress. It's like honey. Yeah, how does it describe it there? Verse 3? It's the lips of an immoral woman drip honey. It's smoother than oil. I mean, it's just smooth. She says everything that you want to hear, right? She tells him what he wants to hear. She builds him up. She laughs at all his jokes. He's so funny. And just everything that could just draw him in and lure him in, that's the way that she speaks. She sounds so good until you yield to her. And they keep going. What are the consequences of yielding to her? But in the end, what's she like?
Bitter.
She's bitter. Wormwood is an herb. Yeah, a bitter herb that would have been familiar during this time. She is bitter, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. Her steps lay hold on hell. She is staggering on her way to hell, and she's looking for company. This is the warning that Solomon gives. Certainly it's talking about the adulteress here. If someone will turn to Hebrews 13, verse 4, and read that for us. Hebrews 13, verse 4. Okay. Marriage is honorable among all and the bed undefiled. God intended for sex to be honorable. And he set parameters on how that could be the case. He intended it to be a good thing, but for it to be a good thing and acceptable in his sight, in what realm must it occur? That's the only acceptable way. That is the only acceptable situation that is pleasing to him. Anything outside of that is sin. No matter how sweet the immoral one might make it sound, no matter how alluring it might be, outside of marriage, sex is sin. And that is very clear. Let's look at some of the consequences of yielding to her. Look at verse 7. "Therefore, hear me now, my children. Do not depart from the words of my mouth. Remove your way far from her. Do not go near the door of her house, lest you give your honor to others and your years to the cruel one, lest aliens be filled with your wealth and your labors go to the house of a foreigner. And you mourn at last when your flesh and your body are consumed and say, 'How I have hated instruction and my heart despised correction. I have not obeyed the voice of my teachers, nor inclined my ear to those who instructed me. I was on the verge of total ruin in the midst of the assembly and congregation.'" Go back up to verse 8 or so. "Son, listen to me. Avoid her like you would the plague." What is it in verse 8? What is the command there, or the warning? Yeah, don't even go near her house. Why would you even give her an opportunity to entice you?
Playing with fire.
Yeah, okay. A great example. The spark goes out if it has no tinder to burn, right? I mean, eventually, if it has no fuel to fuel the fire will go out. And there was a man that we used to worship with. His wife had passed away, and he was immediately set on marrying somebody. I don't know that it mattered who. He started being interested in these women. They weren't Christians. They were trouble. And some of the brethren talked to him and said, "Brother, why are you interested in her? You know, why don't you look?" And he would listen. He got mad. He eventually left. And I remember what one of the men said. He just a plain, blunt spoken man who was one of the elders at Oak Grove said, "What he needs to do is go home and sit in a bucket of ice water. That's what he needs to do. Because he's not thinking straight." Right? He just keeps exposing himself to the temptation and the temptation, and his mind's not clear. What he needs to do is go calm down. Well, he didn't. And again, as I mentioned, he ended up leaving and going somewhere else. But sometimes you just need to separate yourself from the temptation so you can think clearly. John?
Like even for Joseph, he couldn't run away from his situation, and he kept getting tried. He did have to run away.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, when you look at Joseph, there's a wise man, someone very wise, very faithful to the Lord. And we often talk about he does try to talk to Potiphar's wife at first, but it becomes very apparent that she's not interested in talking to him. She doesn't want to hear reason. And then the only option left for a godly man is just leave. He runs. And there's nothing cowardly about that running. That's a wise decision. Good example. What happens if you give in to the immoral woman? And this goes both ways. I mean, the command here is from Solomon to his son, warning against the immoral woman. Does it work in the opposite? I mean, are there immoral men who would do the same thing to women? Absolutely. So take it either way. What is the warning here, or the other things that can happen? Just some of them in the section we just read. Giving in to her can cause you to lose your honor, your good name. It can cause you to lose years of happiness to her charm. We sort of talked about this earlier. The temptation of lust is like drunkenness. You get so caught up in it that you don't think clearly. And you just, this haze comes over and you end up getting caught up in that. You don't see clearly enough to make good decisions. Look at verse 10. The cost is high. Lest aliens be filled with your wealth and your labors go to the house of a foreigner. So physically, can adultery cost you physically? Can it cost you monetarily? Yeah, certainly can. And that's spirituality aside. Certainly spiritually can that cost you if you continue in that. We know that it can. It gives the description of her on her way to hell. And we'll join her there if we continue in that path. But physically it causes so many issues. Can it destroy a family? Can it destroy two? Yeah, I mean, there's so many dangers associated with it here. Look at verse 12. It's almost like if you wake up at the end, you just sort of look around from the days wondering, what in the world have I done? What happened? Verse 12, how I have hated instruction and my heart despised correction. And what I take from this is people tried to tell me. They tried to teach me and warn me. But what did he do? He's been so caught up in it. What did he do?
Ignored.
I didn't listen to him. He keeps on going to say, I have not obeyed the voice of my teachers, nor inclined my ear to those who instructed me. And you've got this description. I was on the verge of total ruin in the midst of the assembly and congregation. I take it to mean the whole congregation was concerned and warned me. But what did I do? Just kept going. And I just kept going because I was blinded by this lust that I was caught up in. Any comments on that?
Similar to Samson. I mean, he was blinded by Delilah, and in the end, it was nothing but destruction.
Yeah, you know, so interesting a case study there. Strongest man that we read about physically. What about his willpower? I mean, so when it came to women, certainly, when it came to that temptation, just so weak and yet so strong in other senses. And that's a very good example. What else? Any other thoughts? John.
Kind of wondering, you know, I guess he's given us some examples too, because it's like, do you want to give up your soul? I mean, do you give up your wealth? Do you give up all your earthly possessions? And somebody that's so focused on the flesh, that might get across to him a little better.
And maybe one reason that he emphasizes that. Here is this. You stand to lose this as well. He starts with the soul earlier, the warning for hell. And then he goes down and says, but it's going to cost you all of these other things too. Just the blindness there is incredible. But does this happen? Is this a real? Are we just reading something that has no application for us? Or is this a real danger for us today just as it was then?
It happens often. Actually, there's more temptation now than there was in years to past. I mean, you got internet. You have more things on TV now than there ever were before. That's now quote unquote acceptable. Mm-hmm. And in addition to all that, it's also selfish.
Yeah.
Because I mean, you're thinking about just you, not necessarily the souls that are around you or the souls in your families.
That's a great point. Great point, Joe.
I think it's interesting here. Wisdom, the words of Solomon, he was surely speaking from experience. What better information from one who has lived that life? So the warning he's giving his son is doing all he can to divert them away from that pitfall. Although Solomon was able to get that life and get to a point where he is now there, his wisdom can be sought after and followed by men. He had lived his life.
And are good people immune to this?
No.
What about David? I mean, Solomon would have known from his own father's experience, right? Did David have trouble with adultery? Yeah. Did David repent of it? Certainly he did. But what about the consequences of it? I believe personally that he ends up facing consequences from that act the rest of his life. When you look at his family life and the situation with his sons that he goes through, I think a lot of that is fallout from his poor example then. So he's repentant, and God certainly forgives him. But there are consequences that have to be borne even after that point. Very, very dangerous and eye-opening, I hope, for us. One of the great things about this section is he gives you the warnings of, you know, don't fall in with the immoral woman. Don't fall into these temptations. And then he tells you how. What you need to do, son, is focus on a godly marriage. Focus on marriage the way that it should be, the way that God intended. And the next section picks up there. Instead of choosing the adulteress, choose to honor a faithful marriage. Verses 15 through 23. So let's read. Let's read 15 through 20, and then And we'll come back and talk about those. Drink water from your own cistern and running water from your own well. Should your fountains be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets, let them be only your own and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice with the wife of your youth. As a loving deer and a graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times and always be enraptured with her love. For why should you, my son, be enraptured by an immoral woman and embraced in the arms of a seductress? Fidelity to one's spouse is compared to pure water, fresh water, running from your own well, these good things. Look at verse 19. This is a very sexual verse. We don't... It is what it is, right? And when you see a verse like this, one thing we need to be reminded of, the Bible is not anti-sex. It's anti-sin. In the right bond, in the right marriage relationship, is sex a good thing? Is it something that God intended to be a good thing and enjoyable? Certainly it is, and I think this verse really points that out. There are some who would believe that sex would be for no other purpose than for making children. This verse to me proves that's absolutely wrong. It is something to be enjoyed between husband and wife within that relationship, within the marriage. Notice the second part of that verse. Always be enraptured with her love. Go back to 18. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice with the wife of your youth. What does that mean? Rejoice with the wife of your youth.
Be happy with her. Content.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting that it doesn't just say live with her. Yeah. Live with the wife of your youth. Well, get through life the best you can with the wife of your youth. What does it say? Rejoice there. Verse 19, what word is used about her love?
English Standard has intoxicated.
That's okay, intoxicated. What's another? Some of the other words?
Enraptured.
You know what that means, right? I mean, when you're enraptured by something, you're just caught up in it. You just soak it all up. Be enraptured with her love. Going back to 18, rejoice with the wife of your youth. When we stop delighting in the love that God has given us in our marriage, does that open the door for the adulteress to walk in? When you stop delighting, when you stop rejoicing, that's when the danger really becomes, it really has an opportunity to come in. Look in. Let's talk about some ways to do that. Some ways to rejoice with the wife, with the husband of your youth. Make sure she's the subject of my love and devotion. Right? You know, when we were dating, how did I treat her? Did I talk to her once a month? You know, when I was around her, did I walk through and grunt and communicate, and that was about the extent of it? When we were dating, is that how we acted? Because what was I trying to do? Well, of course I was. And you know, you're building that relationship then. You want her to know how much you care about her because you want her to see, hey, you know, spending the rest of my life with this guy would be a good thing. Why should I stop that after we get married? Isn't that kind of crazy? I mean, it happens a lot of times, but think, does it make any sense? Let me show you how much I love you. Now we're in a relationship where we can show that love in every way. So I'm going to stop doing it. What kind of craziness is that? It makes no sense whatsoever. And yet it happens all the time. This is something we need to be a parent or be aware of. Am I rude to my wife? You know? Am I rude to her? Was I rude to her when we dated? Would she have married me if I'd been rude to her all the time? These are just questions that... And please, nobody raise your hand and answer. I don't want anybody to answer these, but think about them. You know, can I honestly say, by the way I talk to my wife, that she is the subject of my devotion and love? Should she be?
Yeah.
She should be. And it should be evident to her, and it should be evident to others as well. Go ahead, Bobby.
Yes, you know, when we're dating, we normally get out of the door and go around to the other side of the car, open the door, go up. Well, after we're married for a while, yeah, that's it.
Thank you for the accusation, Bobby. Go ahead, Norris.
I was just gonna say, you know, it just seemed like we have, it's just a human thing, it's something we want, we put all we can into it. It seemed like once you get it, it seemed like I got it, then I don't have to put that. You know, the same way it is about the time of Christmas, once we get it off, we obey it, man, we just, like you were saying earlier, like, well, sometimes we're on fire for it, but then as time goes on, we seem like we don't be on fire for it no more. We still do what we have to do, but it just something changes sometimes.
Yeah. Maybe what happens is we forget the value of them. When we first became a Christian, did you understand the value of the blood of Christ? And then you've been a Christian for 30 years. Well, did the value change? But maybe I've just had it so long, it just became commonplace. That's a terrible shame. Great example. Look, Chuck.
It's kind of like a job interview. I mean, you get all dressed up and put your best face on, show out or whatever. Then once you get the job, you just let your guard down. And we shouldn't do that in a marriage.
Yeah. I think one thing for personal experience, when kids come along, does it get harder in a sense? Because, you know, going back to opening the door, when we get out of the van, where's the first place I go? I go to get them out of the back. You know, but I don't need to forget those other things. You know, just because they are there now, certainly they're a huge responsibility. Who made my family up first? She did, right? Who is my loyalty to when those girls are gone and married? Who's still going to be there? And I don't need to look at her 20 years from now and be like, it starts with an S. Sandy? That's dangerous. And that's what happens sometimes is that relationship grows apart because of kids, and it certainly should. Go ahead, Steve.
It's like anything else. Like you care more about what you have to work for.
Yeah.
It means more to you.
Yeah, he does. Good. Matthew.
Yeah, I think sometimes we forget that marriage, it doesn't matter what the world says, but it's a godly institution.
Yeah.
Do we show the example in marriage to show to other people and also especially kids because they're in the home all the time? Was this the second best choice in my life? Of course, first being baptized. Is this the second best choice, or do you show an example of, well, I wouldn't have done this again if I had the opportunity. It should always be treated as something special because it is an institution given by God. It's a covenant between you, your husband, your wife, and God.
Absolutely. And, you know, what do our kids see? Do they grow up thinking because of what they see, marriage is fantastic. What a great blessing that God has given. Or do they grow up and say, I'm not doing that. Why would I do that? You know, why would I suffer? Like, what kind of example are we showing them day in and day out? There's Bobby.
But, you know, the writer of Proverbs, we know Solomon, even though he got caught up in what he was writing about, he's showing a lot of love for us because we can read it.
Yeah.
And while we're still not alive, we can correct our faults if we examine ourselves. But if we wait too late, we'll be like the man in Luke chapter 16, trying to help his brothers when it was too late.
Yeah. Good point. Just a couple more thoughts on this. I mentioned it. And am I rude to my wife? Do my words build her up or tear her down? Because words can do one of the... They're going to do one of the two things. And, I think of... I'm afraid some men think that being harsh and cruel proves that they're a man. It doesn't. That's not... If you want to be a real man, love your wife. Keep your eyes to yourself and watch your mouth. You do those things. It will help you go far to being a real man and to doing these things. That's what godly men should do. Women, on the other hand, do you encourage your husband? I assure you, he needs it. And he may act tough and like nothing bothers him, but he needs the encouragement. Do you give him honor as head of the household, even if he doesn't deserve it? I know that may sound kind of strange. Let me explain myself. The responsibility as a wife, she is to be subject to her husband, right? but only if he's a good guy, right? That's not what it says. That's not what it says. Now, I'm not advocating staying in a dangerous situation. I'm not doing any of that. But notice what Peter says to wives. If you behave godly, what effect can it have on your husband who's not a Christian? It might cause him to come to the Lord. Do you think he deserved to be treated with honor? Do you think he acted like a good man? I don't. But she treated him that way anyway. Because why does she do it? She loved God. She loved her husband. She wanted him to go to heaven. That's why she did it. And so, you know, I think sometimes we need to remember that honoring there can do so much good to help him be better. Do you show the affection that you should, or do you let other things get in the way? If you're too busy to show your husband affection, then you're too busy. You're just too busy, people. Something is getting in the way. Rejoice in one another. Let's just, if we do that, then the first section of this, the dangers of the adulteress, becomes so much less of a threat. If we're joyful and rejoicing in what God's blessed us with, then that temptation, certainly temptation is always out there, but it's going to have a lot less of an opportunity to sink its fingers into me, right? Any other comments on that? Any thoughts? Okay, let's look at the last section of chapter 5 then. Verse 21, "For the ways of man are before the eyes of the Lord, and he ponders all his paths. His own iniquities entrap the wicked man, and he is caught in the cords of his sin. He shall die for lack of instruction, and in the greatness of his folly, he shall go astray." God has given us the right path. He's given us the way to go, and he sees everything. And it's interesting to me that it comes at the end of this chapter. You know, how many people think they can hide their sins? They think they can sneak around. Nobody knows about it. It's just, I've got it all covered. Who knows? God absolutely knows. He sees every bit of it. And just notice the description there. His own iniquities entrap the wicked man. He's caught in the cords of his own sin. He thinks he is so brilliant and he's got everything planned out. But what's going to happen sooner or later? You keep tying that web, you're going to get caught up in it. Eventually, it's going to come out. And the whole time, God knows anyway. He will die for lack of instruction. And in the greatness of his folly, he will go astray. So we can fool ourselves, but we can't get away from it. Okay, any thoughts on chapter 5 before we move on to 6?
I think it was verse 1 and verse 18 where it's talking about the strange woman. Mm-hmm. ESV has forbidden woman.
Okay, yeah. That's
even better.
It's a good translation. Yeah, yeah. Again, I like it. Strange because you have no right to her. Forbidden, you have no right to her at all. Yeah, very good. Any other ones on chapter 5? John?
I like that he's, you know, when he's talking about marriage and giving you instructions about how to do the right thing, he's taking the time to teach his kids.
Yeah.
Not just showing them, he's telling them.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And the teaching is there, and he is begging them to listen to him. Do you get that? And just the tone of the teaching a lot of times from Solomon? My son, please listen to me. My son, hear me. How does he say at the beginning? Lend your ear to my understanding. Son, I have knowledge that will benefit you, but you've got to listen to me. And I really, when I see this and read it, I see a father begging his children, I can save you so much trouble if you will just listen to me. I mean, how many parents would like to beat that into the head of your kids? Just, I know you know everything, but you don't. Just listen to me. I can save you so much trouble. And Solomon's really saying that not only to, you know, I assume Rehoboam here. He's saying it to us. You know, the way it's been preserved for us, this wisdom, he is pleading with us. Listen to me, son. Don't make these mistakes. Good. Okay, let's start in chapter 6. The first section, 1 through 5 there, talks about foolish financial decisions. And this one, there's a lot to be said about it. Let's go ahead and read it, and then we'll get into it. Someone will read verses 1 through 5 in chapter 6 for us, please.
My son, if you have put up security for your neighbor, have given your pledge for a stranger, if you are snared in the words of your mouth, caught in the words of your mouth, then do this, my son, and save yourself. For you have come in the hand of your neighbor. Go, hasten, and plead urgently with your neighbor. Give your eyes no sleep and your eyelids no slumber. Save yourself like a gazelle from the hand of the hunter, like a bird from the hand of a fowler.
My son, if you become surety for your friend, if you have shaken hands and pledged for a stranger, you are snared by the words of your mouth. You are taken by the words of your mouth. This is the New King James. Now, this does not necessarily mean that we should never, ever, ever, ever co-sign or help someone out in a financial endeavor. But is it a warning? Man, is it a warning? He is very clear about just how dangerous of an action that can be. Turn to, just quickly, we'll look at a couple of verses. Chapter 11, verse 15. This is what Solomon thinks about it. He who is surety for a stranger will suffer, but one who hates being surety is secure. If someone will read chapter 17, verse 18 for us. A man devoid of understanding is the one who is quick to do this. And then the last one we'll look at is chapter 22, verse 26. Do not be one of those who shakes hands in a pledge, one of those who is surety for debts. Do you think he's trying to make a point? You better be careful, right, before you agree to doing this for someone else. Again, it's not saying that we should never be merciful. Leviticus 19. Were there laws in place under the law of Moses to be merciful to others and to help take care of the less fortunate? Leviticus 19. Verse 9, when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest. Why not? So the poor could come by. When you harvested your field, leave the corners, leave the gleanings, so the poor could come, and actually the beast of the field as well, and they could partake of your field. Don't take everything. So certainly, be merciful there. Proverbs 14 talks about helping your neighbor and being merciful to the poor. Proverbs 17:17, be a loving friend. All of that is true. But that doesn't mean you have to sign a loan note with somebody just because they ask you to, right? And this is one of those sections that it has special meaning for me. Being in banking for 15 years has proven to me that the book of Proverbs knows exactly what it's talking about in this subject. It is absolutely spot on 3,000 years after it was written. Now, how can this still be so spot on 3,000 years later? Man is the same. He's exactly the same. His behavior is the same. That's why this still works. John?
Sometimes we have a hard time following the word, and we're falling short and sinning. And you got people making a deal with people. You got two imperfect people trying to make a deal with you. You're going to have like compounded problems.
Yeah, that's a good point. Good point. Here's the thing. Just some things to think about, some things to consider. Who is my first obligation to? My family. To God. Yeah, absolutely. Let's say that. My first obligation, even financially, is to give back as I've been blessed to the Lord. After that, it's to take care of my family, right? I'm not to be a burden on you if I can in any way provide for my family myself. So what happens if I get roped into a payment that my friend defaults on? Now who's affected by it? My family, yeah. I mean, so this is not, it's not being hateful, it's making sure you can meet your responsibility. Now two families are in trouble because I acted impulsively. I think of customers who have gotten in trouble doing this. A lot of times it was older customers. Their grandchildren would come and want to get loans. And I remember a family as sweet as they could be, a husband and wife, just, I mean, some of the best customers I ever had. And they came in and said, we want to help our grandson get a car loan. And he's just such a good boy. And he does so much for us. And I knew them and I knew him. And you know, I always felt like kind of a jerk when I was a loan officer because I asked questions. And I said, Did he do a lot for you before he wanted you to help him with the car loan? Well, you know, he's busy and he's got a lot going on, but he's such a good boy. We know he's going to take care of this. And, you know, I just keep asking all of these things, and they were determined to do it. So they helped him, got a car, nice car, made the first payment, never heard from him again. And when I called them, actually, I didn't have to call them. They were good customers. The system automatically generated a late payment notice. And so as soon as they got, I'm not saying don't help people, but be careful about entering into this. The thing, and just some things for us, if we decide to do this, we decide to help someone else, go ahead and assume that you're going to pay it. Right? If you're going to agree to co-sign, just go ahead and assume that the worst is going to happen and you're going to pay it. And if you can't afford to do it, don't sign. Right? Because something can very easily come up. And even those with the best intentions, things can come up. And again, I mean, this is not a class on banking, but this is Bible teaching. Is this something that can keep us out of some headaches in this life? It is. And God gives us certainly spiritual things, but also things that can help us in our day-to-day life. Proverbs is great for that. So, something to keep in mind. And then notice 2 through 5, the verses there. If you realize you made a bad decision, get out of it as quick as you can. Beg to be released from it. Try as you might to get free from it. But is that always easy? From a loan officer's perspective, I tell you what, if you're the strength behind it, and you come to me a year later and say, well, you know, doesn't he have enough credit built up? I'd like to get my name off of it. Probably not. Because why did I make it? I made it because of you and because of your strength. And now maybe he's proven himself. But what happens if I take your name off of it and he immediately stops paying? Now who's in trouble? Yeah, now who goes before the loan committee and they look and say, Lance, why did you let this strong customer go and put somebody with practically no strength? You know what my answer is? Because I'm an idiot. That's why. That is the only answer there. And I say that to say getting out of an obligation like this is not easy. So be careful before you ever sign it. Be careful before you ever enter into doors.
You know, Lance, you know, we see today that it's court shows and TV is full of those type of shows, and it break families up, and you know,
yeah.
People don't, you know, they do, like you were saying, do things like that for their kids and they don't pay, and you know, and they stop speaking to one another and all that kind of stuff like that. It just causes so many tremendous problems and stuff.
It does.
You know, and break up families and stuff.
It is unbelievable what the damage that money and credit can cause to families and relationships, friendships. Notice how it's compared, and I'll leave it at this, but just notice the description that Solomon gives in trying to get out of such an agreement. Give no sleep to your eyes, nor slumber to your eyelids. Don't sleep until you get out of it. Deliver yourself like a gazelle from the hand of a hunter. Man, I mean, that's pretty descriptive, right? Do whatever you can to get out, but he's not advocating breaking your vow. You are obligated to keep your part of it. But if you can get out of it legally, get away from it. Don't let yourself be bound in the obligation of another. Okay, we've got about 5 more minutes. Let's look at the next section. 6 through 11. Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise, which having no captain, overseer, or ruler, provides her supplies in the summer and gathers her food in the harvest. How long will you slumber, O sluggard? When will you rise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep. So shall your poverty come upon you like a prowler, and your need like an armed man. Verses 6 through 11 is a warning against laziness. And what example does it give to us of someone who is not lazy? The ant. Go look at the ant and see how she works. Consider the work habits of the ant. She works independently, right? She does what needs to be done without having a captain, without having an overseer over her cracking the whip saying, you need to do this and you need to do that. What does the ant do?
Knows what to do.
She knows what needs to be done and she does it. Why does she do it? Because it has to be done. Yeah, and she knows the importance of it. She does it. It's her job to do it. She knows her work. She does it diligently. She works. She's industrious. She works because the work needs to be done. She prepares ahead for bad days. She makes sure that there is something for later. I turn to Colossians chapter 3. This is probably the last passage that we read. Colossians 3. If someone will read verses 22 through 24 in Colossians 3, 4.
Bondservants, obey in everything those who are your earthly masters, not by way of eye service as people pleasers, but with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord. Whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord and not for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance as your reward. You are serving the Lord Christ.
Here Paul writing to Christians. What kind of employees should Christians be? Should be. Shouldn't we? Shouldn't we be the best employees that someone could ask for? Notice just some of the things mentioned here. Don't serve your masters, your employers, with eye service as men pleasers. What does that mean?
Kiss up.
Yeah, you know, you say all the right things when they're there, and you say the things that make them feel good, and then when they walk off, what do? You walk off too, right? I mean, you just kind of disappear. Don't do that. Do it with, how is it said there in verse 22? Sincerity of heart, because you what? You fear God. You do it not because your boss is watching you. You work hard because God is watching you, and you understand that. Whatever you do, do it heartily as to the Lord and not to men. If we do that, we'll be the kind of employees we should be. We'll understand the value. We'll understand the necessity of hard work. Again, a New Testament teaching that really backs up what Solomon is saying there. On the flip side of that, he starts talking. That's what should be done. But then he starts talking to the sluggard. Verses 9 through 11, What kind of trouble, and the sluggard, of course, a lazy person, what kind of trouble does he bring upon himself? Yeah. A little folding of the hands, a little sleep, and then poverty just swallows you up. It's like it came out of nowhere. Did it come out of nowhere? It was coming all along. You've been heading that direction the whole time. This is certainly a warning here. Verse 11, poverty will come upon you like a prowler and your need like an armed man. Laziness will leave you just as poor as if you'd been what? If somebody robbed you. It'd be like somebody just came and robbed you blind. That's what that habit will lead us to. Just one reminder. Even in the midst of the Garden of Eden, before sin came in and broke that up, even then Adam had something to do, right? It was his job to tend the garden. Now, it would have been much easier before sin came in, certainly. But it's interesting to me that God has always given man something to do. And he expected him to do it, and to do it with diligence. And a lesson just for us in all that we do, whatever the case is, in our jobs, as we raise our children, in studying to teach the gospel, plug in whatever you want to. He expects us to be diligent. He expects us to work at what we do. Any last comments? Matt.
The idle mind's the devil's playground.
Yeah.
Kind of makes me think about that in this section. You know, if you're being lazy, you're not, your mind's not thinking of doing things and staying busy and whatever your laziness encompasses, sitting around, but that starts letting the devil play in your mind of things that you could do that, you know, aren't very Christian-like, and start being tempted to sin.
Very good. I think it's interesting. It has a spiritual, mental effect. In many cases, it even has a physical effect. I think of Sasha's great-grandfather was 95 or so when he died. And you know why he lived that long? He worked till he was about 92. I mean, till he couldn't go. When he was an old man, he would still go down to the park down the road and pick up trash. I mean, he's in his 90s then. It was before he just couldn't walk anymore. And you think, how do they live so long? Because they worked their whole life. You know, their bodies are strong. And so that's just one additional aspect of it. Not always, but what if you're lazy, even in a physical sense? What if you don't ever do anything? Yeah, does it affect us physically? Does it affect us emotionally? You know, someone who has nothing to do, how easy is it for depression to set in and things like that? And so, you know, a lot of different ways this affects us. Certainly spiritually it has some effects. Okay, we'll pick up there next week, Lord willing. Thanks for the comments.